socially working. So all the answers, of course, I'm only give you the answers I have, which is not the answers to all the questions there are, right? And most of these answers were obtained in collaborations with all of these people. So Kurt and I think we started working, it's almost 10 years now. We started worrying about these things. Kurt and Gary had been involved in that already 15 years, 20 years, old story. So Matthias, who was my successor, he did a lot of simulations. Rolf was a diploma student and postdoc in our lab. Boris used to be my diploma student, and he did part of the theory work I'm going to talk about. And Carsten now has the big task of trying to find out if that is any good or not. And Arvind is doing also network-related stuff, but something else. Okay, so what I want to talk about is, I'll give a very brief introduction into rubber elasticity, because I think with this audience I can be very brief. And then I'll try to argue that if you take a closer look, it is a difficult problem, but maybe it's worthwhile looking at. Then I'll talk about computer simulations, how and why. So the how will also be very short. The why a little bit longer, because I just like doing that. Then one main part will focus on trying to go from the classical theories of rubber elasticity to tube models and to see sort of theoretically why one may want to do that, and then also use the simulations to check if the assumptions one makes are any good or not. And then the last part will be sort of tubes versus slip, and that's just three transparencies, but I thought I should say that, and a little bit more about a topological analysis of entanglements. Okay, so introduction to rubber elasticity. But we have statistical mechanics problem, right? What we do is we have a macroscopic material, we strain the material, empirically we know it's incompressible, so if I stretch it by a factor of lambda here, it's going to shrink by a factor of square root of lambda in the other two directions. And if we do this macroscopically, what we can measure is, well, rheology, and my rheology actually cooks down to a single number, which is the shear modulus, so if you wait long enough, that's what I always have in mind. Now, this you want to relate or explain by something which is going on a molecular level, and there we have a polymer network, something which is created by cross-linking long linear chains. All of this is going to take place at melt density. And what we want to know is what is going to go on in this little part of the system when I strain the large system. So how are these chains deformed? And what we have to explain is why, in the process of being deformed, they lose so much entropy that they produce the restoring forces which we observe macroscopically. So that's the task. Now, the, I guess, 60-year-old view on rubber elasticity, which explains actually qualitatively all of it, quantitatively a large chunk of the phenomena, is that what you can do is you can consider the chains between the crosslinks as linear entropic springs, because you say, well, a linear polymer in a melt adopts a Gaussian configuration, and then from that entropy argument you can come up with an expression for an entropic spring, which is just linear. And then the simplest theory say, well, all I should do is I should keep the crosslinks in my theory. Now, this is the most primitive network you can imagine. I think it goes back to Flory, where there's only a single movable crosslink. And then the question you ask is, suppose I deform the outer boundaries of this in a manner which is volume conserving, what is going to happen to this system here? Now, the two big answers you get from that is, first, well, what is the shear modulus? And that's just, well, let's say this is a little bit of scaling here, so I don't care too much about the prefactor here. Since the energies involved in stretching these chains here, entropic springs are of the order of kT, and you do this stretching for the strands, and the shear modulus is an energy density in terms of units, what you get is kT times the density of elastically active strands. The second thing which you get from these considerations is you get a stress-strain relation, which looks... So that's a stress-strain. Ah. Big mistake, yeah. It's actually in there. It's not. I can't blame it on the resolution of this thing. that's funny. But it is a computer mistake, I'm sure. I stole that from another transparency and this converting stuff. Well, anyways. So now this looks surprisingly complicated because I was talking about just linear springs, right? So why is it slightly more complicated? The reason is just that you stretch in one direction, you have linear springs there. You compress in the other two directions, it's again linear springs. And that combination is responsible for this, well, nonlinear, some people say, neo-Hookian behavior. So that is, let's say, 40 years old. Is it any good? Well, that is an attempt to import a transparency into a PowerPoint presentation. Originally, I copied that from a paper by James and Guth, the inventors of the Phantom model, which is sort of the mother of all models I'll be talking about. So it's 1943, and the line here, the blue line is the experiments, and the red dots are the theory, and that's essentially the theory I've been talking about. Now, this is stretching by a factor of 5. You see this non-linear stress-strain relation. And so if you get that kind of an agreement, then I think you're pretty happy, right?
It's not quite the expression
that
you wrote, right?
It's what?
It's not quite the expression you found in the
It's a changing curvature.
Yeah, but this is the difference between thermodynamic and engineering stress. So it's the, if you put in the, what is it?
No,
isn't
no?
There like, no. Did you put like a little bit of,
In this here?
Yes. This the expression you described before and the one you have for the engineering stress on the bottom never has a curvature which goes upward. It always goes
always like that.
Okay, so I have to convince myself what I really copied.
This isn't Russ-Langevin. It has a correction for finite.
They put that in? Okay, so that's even then the next version if you want to describe it. So what I'll be interested in actually is more the small strain behavior. In that case, these two things agree, and I think I'm on the same side. Okay, so that looks like a problem that is solved, and still I'm going to claim that it's difficult. Now, why? Now, of course, if you have that kind of an agreement, as we've seen before, then you get daring, and what you do is you just divide the experimental results by the theory. And then if the theory is perfectly correct, you expect to find, if you plot this reduced strain against reduced stress against the strain, just a constant. Now, in this case here, the blue dots are actually the experiment, and you see that's not really a constant. And you also see lots of theories in there, which I will not discuss in detail, but all I want to say is that there is different physics in these theories. And these theories have one or two parameters, and they manage more or less to describe this thing. So there is some understanding, and we'll talk about that.
The dashed line?
Which? Another theory. I don't know which one is that. So. They just, I mean, what Gottlieb and Gaylord did is they just assembled data and the different theories, and usually also have the nice plot with the expressions, which are pretty horrible. And so on the one hand, this is good. On the other hand, what it meant for me was that I thought, well, maybe that's not the way to find out what is really going on. For example, this debate we'll see a little later about entanglements, what do they really do? If you have theories which make very different assumptions about the existence or non-existence of the tube but come up with identical expressions for the stress-strain relations, then by fitting that, you cannot really distinguish. What is a bit more interesting is if you look at how the shear modulus depends on the strand length. Now, the strand length you can estimate from your chemistry if you know how many crosslinks you have put in, more or less. So that's this axis here. And now, the classical result is that the shear modulus should be proportional to the density of strands. So that's just this line here. And I mean, that's from the 50s, and people already had data which seemed to extrapolate to a finite value in the limit where there are no more crosslinks. And that is, of course, a sign of entanglements, of sort of extrapolating to the tube value for melts. Michael?
Yeah,
Do you happen to know what the slope is? Well, this has to do with functionality of processes. Does that work or not?
Well, I guess this is the classical prediction.
Right, but it's which classical? There are several classical predictions. There's affine and phantom, and which one is this line?
I don't know. I don't know which line
somewhere
that is.
Somewhere in between, as always.
Yeah. Okay. So there are some deviations. You think, well, we have this beautiful first order theory. Now let's just do a little bit of work and just fix the whole thing. And then you start to think about networks more seriously, and then you get terribly scared. Because what they are systems which have lots of disorder, and they have lots of different kinds of disorder, and sort of it's quenched disorder. So it's disorder which is determined by the way you prepare the network, and then it doesn't change anymore. If you do statistical mechanics, you have to take that into account. So by the way, whenever I say anything smart and I don't claim it explicitly for me, it's probably due to some efforts. So this line probably he can claim for himself as well. So one problem is polydispersity. If you do random cross-linking, then the distance between cross-links along the chains is of course random. It's very irregular. You have things like dangling ends, where sort of the last cross-link is here and the chain is going on there. And then of course you know you can have enormous relaxations times because it's like star polymers. You have things like self loops where a chain reacts with itself, which makes the analysis of these things more complicated. And you have what we are most interested in here, you have entanglement, so chains going through here, but you would imagine that they could also transport stress like this. Okay, so why should one study networks? Well, first of all, of course, because I think they may and can be studied in their own right, and they are commercially very important. For the purposes of this workshop here, I would say there is an advantage. Advantage is that now we have a static problem. So I don't have to worry about the dynamics here if I confine myself to the shear modulus. And also, I think it allows us to study the properties of the tube under deformation independent from all the dynamic processes, which are usually sort of thought to take place in the tube, but we don't quite know how the tube really looks like when you deform the system. So in this case, we don't have to worry about reptation, contour length fluctuations, constraint release, because it just shouldn't appear due to the very fact that the ends are clamped to each other. Okay, so simulations. Now, the model we always use is the model Kurt and Gary invented like 15 years ago. And it's just the simplest kind of polymer you can imagine studying on the computer. You have little beads which interact with repulsive Lennard-Jones interactions. It's a very short range, which means it's very efficient if you want to simulate it. And then you just connect these beads by relatively strong springs. That's clearly it is a polymer. And since all the theories we are talking about don't have any information about chemical details, we can use whatever polymer to study that.
So for neighbor beads, why don't you use Hookian spring?
I think we could very well. If you think about simulating isolated things, then you don't really want to have Hookian springs because then there are problems with equilibration. But I think for everything we do, this would be completely the same.
One is you have a finite extendable spring. The other one is finite potential is computationally very efficient because when you calculate the force, you don't have to calculate a single square root. But with a harmonic potential, you have to calculate square root and that directly makes it slower. Potential even is faster.
Okay, so if that's a harmonic potential which has a certain extension, if you would just replace the Feeney by the Hookian spring, I think for most of what you're doing, you wouldn't see
the
difference.
The reason is to enforce uncrossability. Like
because of a finite extendability.
Yeah. Okay, so that's going to be on the slide after this one. So what are the properties of this model? First of all, if you forget about the bonds, I mean, this is like a dense monomeric liquid. So we have packing and all these things as in liquid. If you connect the chains and you look at them in the milk, then there are Gaussian on large scales, and well, you have some effective stiffness here. But it's a very flexible chain.
What's the correlation angle in your milk compared to the bond?
Which correlation angle?
Well, you have a finite density.
Yeah, but it's the same thing. It's very dense.
Do you have a quantitative number for
You mean the correlation length? Yeah. So it would be just a monomer size. There isn't.
There is
yeah. I mean, analyzing what is going on in these systems by saying, okay, I want to come from the usual scaling pictures for semi-dilute solutions and extract a reasonable number from that would be just.
Look at it for scaling, but there is a physical quantity for correlation.
Yeah, you could. Yeah, okay. It's just small. They're very dense. Well, for the concentration fluctuations in the metal, I guess.
One bond
line.
Yeah, like 85% bonding fraction.
Yeah, it's really dense. Okay, so the other.
Your notation B is bond length and sigma is this Leonard Jones.
Yeah, and it's basically the same thing. So.
B is then something like an average bond length.
Yeah, because sort of it's the repulsive interaction plus the attraction between neighboring bonds. So it's a little bit smaller than one. Okay, so now the one property I do care about is that if you have two strands here, it is very difficult for them to lose that entanglement property. So there is an energy barrier which is of the order of 70 kT for going from this state to this state. So when we run the system with the full potentials, then we may say, if we don't pull them too strongly, we may say that the topology is conserved. That's the one property I want to build in. It's not really breaking, because what they do is you have two beads which are connected by a spring, and you can pull them apart, right? Now, if you want to have two bonds, they can slip through each other by pulling this way, and then they can go through. So they would not be broken after this, but they could slip through each other, and the energy barrier for that is 70 kT.
Why can't you adjust your potential to the infinity just by making your Rmax smaller?
Because you don't want to have two stiff potentials that makes your time step horribly short. And these potentials are optimized in such a way that the bonds don't give you a smaller time step than you already have due to the extruded volume interactions. Well, in these units, it's 85%. I think it's Van der Waals rented, 40%, right?
And the volume density is a little bit above 0.4. And that is almost exactly the average volume density a typical experimental polymer might have. They are also usually not below 50% volume density. And take Van der Waals phenomena of an experimental system. And so it's essentially an incompressible system.
You
take a standard polymer, calculate the Van der Waals volume of a chain, and take the volume of the object, and you're always below 50% micro.
Okay, I'll let you guys figure that out later. Now,
going back to this possibility, is that you could also change the potential and look for something like an extrapolation to infinite spring and see if anything that you're measuring, if there's any dependence or if there's convergence.
You could do that. So now the reason why do we want to do simulations, or why might that be interesting? So in my mind, there are two points. The first point is that we have a pretty good control over the network structure we are studying. And so you can imagine studying sort of networks which are very much like in experiments, where you do random cross-linking, you can do end cross-linking, but you can also study things which are not so easy to prepare experimentally, but which are simpler in the sense that they take out part of this disorder I was talking about, and then maybe one can sort of try to understand these first and then go to the more complicated systems later. So one example are networks which have a connectivity which is the same as in a crystal lattice, and that's what my initial examples will be about. But you could also imagine these Olympic gels, as Tijen called them, where sort of I always imagine that they are just randomly concatenated. So that's the case that I find interesting. So that's the first reason why simulations may be interesting. The second reason is that at the same time you can measure, well, quote unquote, because of course we are studying finite systems, but still macroscopic properties, and you can look at the microscopic structure and dynamics, and you remember this STAT-MAC problem was about connecting these two things. So it's nice to have them at the same time and then see what really comes out. So macroscopic properties, well, what we can do, for example, is we can just take our simulation box, strain it in this volume-conserving way, then we can measure normal stresses. You just have to average them for quite a long time because it's a soft system and it is a very small system, so the fluctuations are huge, but you can do that. So it's after a step strain, and then you can plot these step strains against something which is, again, inspired by this classical law. Now you see there's a minus one. And from the slope here, you can extrapolate a reasonable estimate of the shear modulus. And then you can go to the microscopic side and just look, for example, at the extension of the network strands between the crosslinks, because that is what all the classical theories of rubber elasticity are all about. They tell you that is what you should first calculate, and then you should take it and calculate the stress from it, and that should be the whole story. So now we can measure it. That's nice. And the other thing, and that is a little bit related to the question we had, can the bonds break? You can also try and calculate a local stress distribution if you strain these systems a little bit harder. So now this is stretched by a factor of 3 or 3.5. And it's difficult to see, but so this is a dense network. And we show those parts of the network which have lots of stress. They are sort of shown thick and red. And then they are sort of, the reason why they don't continue here is that this is done in periodic boundary conditions. So there is a bit over here which belongs to the same chain. And what you can see here is that stress is propagated through chemical crosslinks here, but it is also propagated through entanglements like here. And there's another mesh coming like here and doing that. Okay.
So each one of those things corresponds to a single chain. You're going to need these
visible regions. Yeah.
And then the chain's fluctuating quite a bit.
So this is a snapshot for the configuration, but stresses averaged over a long time.
Is this actually a measure of how alpine the deformation is?
That is something one can try and get out of these things, of course. I mean, that's one of the things one wants to measure. How affine is the deformation? On which length scale does it become affine? We'll get to that later. Okay. So I think these are two advantages. And what I like doing with this is sort of I like to try out the ideas behind the theories or like the model to see if that is any good. And the second step is that you can say, okay, if the ideas may be any good, is there a theory? And if there's a theory, then it should be possible to test it without adjustable parameters. Okay, so now classical theories, tube models. So with respect to entanglements, well, the classical theories, what they do is they throw away all the chain conformations between the crosslinks. So they only keep the crosslink positions in the theory, if you like. So in that way of thinking, the only thing entanglements can do is they can reduce the fluctuations of the crosslinks. And so that is what constrained junction theories are all about. Now, the two people would say, well, that's nice and well, but you should also worry about the fact that the chains between the crosslinks cannot just do everything, but they are confined in their motion as well, and you should account for that. Okay, so now what I'll try is I'll try to show little illustrations from these diamond networks and then just develop the argument. So this is a snapshot, and these are the averaged monomer positions in a network which has the connectivity of a diamond lattice. So you see here clearly the regular structure, but this thing is fluctuating a lot. So if you look at this plot here, you would probably not be able to tell me that this has this diamond lattice connectivity. You can find it out by averaging, and you get this here.
See, what are the properties of the links? I mean, the links that you just have diamond. Are you just saying that the topology is constrained to be diamond-like, and you have fluctuating chains in the
Yes,
chain?
And I would always use the word connectivity here, because with topology I mean this. So just, but sort of these are, if you average positions here, then on average they would end up on this regular structure.
But, I mean, okay, but and that's just I'm just choosing this map. I mean, I would imagine that if you want your structure should be fluctuating also that.
This is a snapshot, yes. And I think it shows fluctuations. And this is no, an average cannot fluctuate, right? You just average the position until kingdom come. Well, of course, it's cheating, but anyways.
There are no
No, it's a single phantom network. So we are starting with a single phantom network, and I was just showing this to show you a 3D thing because when I do drawings, I can only do it in 2D. So a phantom network, how does that work? Well, if you want to characterize it, you have some nodes in your theory here, which, well, have some position, which depends on time. Another bit of information is you need to know the connectivity, so which monomers I and J are connected. And then you have a Hamiltonian, which is just this linear entropic spring Hamiltonian. So that defines the phantom network. If you want to do anything with it, it's pretty useful to change the notation a little bit and to say, well, for each monomer, I consider or write the position, the instantaneous position, as a sum of a ground state average position plus a deviation from that. So the ground state would, with my square lattice connectivity here, look like this. And then there are fluctuations around the ground state. And if you do that, the Hamiltonian just has these two independent parts. Now, for a phantom network, the important thing is that the fluctuations only depend on the connectivity. They don't depend on the strain which you put on the system. So that's one thing. The other thing is it is more convenient sometimes, and for the rest of the talk it will be crucial, to write them as a sum over independent modes. So they are sometimes called generalized Rouse modes. So it's the same thing as the Rouse modes for a linear chain, but for a more complicated connectivity. Now, the whole stress in the phantom network is due to the sort of the change in the equilibrium positions. You don't have to worry about this at all. Completely unimportant for a phantom network. Now, the picture I was showing you was a picture of a single of these diamond networks, which are sort of a slightly more advanced version of the old Flory trick with four chains. Now, what you have to realize is that in the volume of these four chains here, there are actually square root of n crosslinks, because the typical extension of a chain is square root of n in a meld. And so to have a dense system, there are many more crosslinks in here than I show you now. And these crosslinks would not be connected to the ends here. Now, if you want to imitate that for the diamond networks, then what we have to do is we just have to take several of these snapshots independently, put them into the same simulation box, and then introduce an extruded volume interaction, the full potential, so that they sort of get off each other locally. You have dense, the typical dense packing in a meld, and because the potentials are chosen the way they are defined, at that moment you quench the topology, so the chains can no longer cross each other. So you introduce entanglements randomly, and then they stay. And we're interested in what is the effect of that. Well, the first thing you may look for is, does it change the conformations of the systems? So the quantity I'm looking at here is, it's just the end-to-end distance distribution of the network strands, or the distribution of the distances between connected crosslinks. Now, the blue line is what you get from the theory for phantom networks. And the dots are actually measured in these systems after the kind of treatment I've shown you. So if you look at ensemble averages for static properties, then this process, this introduction of entanglements, this freezing in of topology, hasn't changed anything for an ensemble average.
Well, this is all for the diamond.
That's for the diamond. Mm-hmm.
For five interpenetrating diamond lattices, is that right?
Yeah, okay. So that's where the data is for.
Now, how do you determine how stretched the original diamond lattice is? Since for a given diamond lattice, you have to pick a unit cell,
mm-hmm.
and that enters as a parameter in the classical theory.
Yes. Now, the stupid answer, and that was the answer we used when we prepared the systems, was that we said, okay, it should be just the typical mean square end-to-end distance in the melt. Now, if you understand these systems afterwards, then you realize that you should have chosen less factor of 1/2. Because in that case, the sum of the sort of the mean extension, because they are pre-stretched, plus the remaining fluctuations produces just the typical size. And in our original thing, we forgot about the fluctuations, and okay.
Does that mean you have a negative pressure? The network is pulling on the walls then?
Yes, the phantom network would do that, yes.
It compresses.
No, it's stretched. Ours are stretched.
So it doesn't agree really with what should be in the mount. If you were to cut the thing, you would not get the same distribution.
Ours are stretched relative to the mount. But the way I'm analyzing them is just trying to figure out ways so that I don't have to worry about it. Because all of these things, where they go, is just into this bit here, into the stretching of the original conformations. So they do affect the phantom shear modulus these systems have. And since the fluctuations are independent of that, and all I'll be doing is analyzing the fluctuations, I don't have to worry about it.
Doesn't the main term contribute to stress as well?
But that's the phantom contribution, which we know and which we can calculate. It is there,
yeah,
of course.
You have to check it numerically. I mean, you assume that everybody believes phantom model, and there are a significant fraction of the rubber community that doesn't believe phantom model is right.
Okay, so, that's what we measure, right?
But you phantom model is part of you should easily be able to check it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, we have checked it for the non-interacting chains, then we get the result we expect. We have checked it for chains which have local packing but can cut through each other. We get the same result. And in the more complicated system, of course, where we don't have an exact answer, we say, okay, this is what we assume, like every theory, and so we have to explain the difference between the phantom result and what we really measure. Okay, so the statics was not affected. But what happens if you look at the motion of an individual crosslink or an individual chain? The simplest way of doing that is measuring the autocorrelation functions for these generalized Rouse modes or some approximation to the generalized Rouse modes. And then what you see is that they don't decay to zero anymore. So on average, nothing happens, but any particular part of the network is confined in its motion.
Now we're true even for the pattern.
No.
The end-to-end vector certainly doesn't get randomized for one of these links.
That is true, and that's what we're going to use later. But if I talk about the eigenmodes of the phantom network, then what I say is right. Right?
So there's at least one degree of freedom, the end-to-end vector, which doesn't get randomized.
But then you don't look at the eigenmodes of the phantom network, then you look at the original chain. And that's the bit which I'm hiding in my ground state positions here.
Okay.
And that's important, because if you don't do it,
tracking off the average.
Yes.
Okay.
And if you don't do that, all this analysis produces horrible things. Took me a while to figure that out, actually.
So, Ralph, is it still a phantom system?
No, this is the full system with topology conservation.
Correct.
Right?
If you take the topology, you make that individual.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was trying to say. Okay, now we want to model that, right? That is the original Edwards idea, 35 years old. So what you say is, so they are relative to the phantom case. There are additional interactions. And what they do is they somehow localize the networks somewhere around their phantom equilibrium position. So what you do is you introduce additional harmonic potentials, which try to excite the monomers away from their phantom network mean position, and they go to some other position here, which I denote by little v, and there are little springs here, which in general may depend on the deformation. So that's the way all these constrained fluctuation models work. Now, if you do that, you have to specify two things. You have to say, well, how do I actually choose these cavity or tube positions? I mean, cavity, I mean the classical theories. Well, clearly on average, they have to vanish relative to the phantom model equilibrium position, because we already know we don't disturb the statics, but we still have to say how far are they away on average from where the molecules would be otherwise.
These are strings attached to single monomers.
Mm-hmm.
I could have had a matrix where, or I could have, one another example was to do it in terms of mode amplitudes rather than monomers, which would have been some sort of delocalized.
We'll come to the modes in a second.
But
so now we do it.
Here you specifically mean you attach a spring to each monomer.
Yes. Yes.
Can I ask you a question? Is this the potential of the tube that you were talking about before, Michael?
Same thing. So if what he says, he has
it's a now harmonic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it equivalent?
Well, you have to give more information about what how you play those things and everything else. Say it's equivalent. But it looks the starting point is equivalent.
Yeah.
It's an adverse 65, 67 papers.
Yeah.
Except there's no lambda in front.
Well, that is my next point, that if you have to say what happens under strain. Now, one thing is clear, the points to which you pull, they have to move in a manner which is affine with the sample, because otherwise this is just going to be a mess. But it's not so clear from the outset if the strength of the confining potential should be deformation independent or not. And, okay, so these are the two things we have to find out. Now, I'm coming to the modes. A nice thing, which I only noticed last year, actually, was that if this is the Hamiltonian where we attach the springs in real space, and there's sort of, the only condition is that the strength, sort of the spring is the same for all monomers you're keeping your theories. But if you do that, then this thing is also diagonal in the generalized Rouse modes, which are determined by the connectivity. So that's a pretty nice thing. And why? Because now, if you look at the Hamiltonian for a given mode, and for a given realization of the disorder, so I'm pulling somewhere and I hold that fixed for the minute, then what we have to worry about is a thing which is sort of it's one particle moving against two springs between zero and this position V here. Now that is so simple that even I can solve it. Because if there are two springs, what do you know? You know that there is going to be some equilibrium position between these two points, zero and the V, and that's just given by this expression here. And around that new equilibrium position, you're going to have thermal fluctuations, but they are going to be reduced relative to the case where there is no constraint, no localization, because now you have to fight against two springs. So that's this. So that is the central thing which makes all of this so simple. Okay, so the first question I have to answer is where do I put the tube, if you like. So I have to specify the width of the distribution for these points where I'm pulling to, or for the modes. Well, the condition is, as we saw, that in the state of preparation, we do not change static expectation values. So the sum of the reduced mean square thermal fluctuations and the quenched in mean excitations has to be the same thing as what you would observe for the phantom model. For this mode, it's just kT over this effective spring constant for the mode. So that is the condition which you have to fulfill. And that links the position of the tube, which is this thing here, to the strength of the springs, my parameter L. And you can express that for every mode by a degree of confinement, which is a number between 0 and 1. So 0 means it's not confined at all, so this thing is going to behave like in the phantom case. And 1 means it is completely localized. Everything that was due to thermal fluctuation in the phantom network is now just fixed, localized in space. And then this here is the recipe how to choose the tube axis, if you like, and that is what you get from that. Okay, so the second question we have to answer is, what happens under strain? And so there are basically two answers, which I call model A and model B. Model A says, well, the strength of the confining potential is deformation independent. Model B says these cavities or tube deform in a manner which is affine with the macroscopic strain. Okay, so model A, so the spring doesn't change, and then actually the result of this is something which is very, very simple. And it looks entirely like the original phantom network, in the sense that the equilibrium positions deform in a manner which is affine with the strain, and the fluctuations around them are strain independent.
Is it a phantom or is it a Tedder's model? If you have a fine, if your strings don't deform with strain, you can recover Tedder's model.
Yes.
Not phantom.
But what I'm saying is the qualitative behavior looks as in the phantom network. What is going to come out of it is the Edward Warner theory. Okay, model B says, no, these cavities, tubes, deform in a manner which is affine with the strain, so that for springs gives you this kind of relation. And then this gets complicated. We have something which is relatively simple for the tube, but for what I call the sausage, the thing you can see, you get a much more, well, complicated relationship. So it's the equilibrium positions deform in a manner which is sub-affine. It's sort of these extensions become, well, they're not deformed affinely, but weaker. And the fluctuations, at least parallel, become larger. And one has to combine these two things.
This component's parallel.
It would be parallel and perpendicular, because since we're talking about springs, I should have said that, but we're talking about springs, we can decompose the thing in the three spatial directions. Yeah. So the lambda is either lambda or 1 over square root of lambda if I talk about... Okay, sorry, I didn't make that clear. Yeah, it's anisotropic. If you like, it's a tensorial response thing.
For large lambda, the first equation leaves 0, right? Which means?
It means that if the tube becomes, or the cavity becomes wider and wider and wider, then at some point this effective spring becomes so weak that it does not deform the phantom network anymore.
Because UP is the deviation with respect to the phantom.
Mm-hmm. Yes, or it's the excitation of an eigenmode of the phantom network.
Okay.
So if we do this for the crosslinks only, then that's the Roncal-Legrand, Flory, Ehrmann, whatever theory, the basic version of that. And if you do it for tubes, then you get Heinrich and Straube, Vanikov, Rubinstein. I think that's just always equivalent. Okay. Now, the elastic properties you get from these two models. Now, my favorite is this here, because that's a point Michael also made the other day. If you look at that, then there's this funny property that these extra springs do not contribute to the stress. Now, it's a subtle point. I'm happy to discuss that at any length, but not now. The model A is something which it's a bit weird, it sounds a bit inconsistent, it makes sense in some sense, so again, but what comes out of it anyways is that the stress-strain relation you would get from that model is just the classical one, so you cannot explain any deviations, while here you get deviations. And the other thing you see is that if you have, for a given degree of confinement, gamma, the contribution to the stress is much weaker here than here, because gamma squared is less than gamma. No. Okay. So now, sort of, we can just try out by the analysis of the fluctuations what is the correct answer. So, sort of, the original dispute was, does it matter what happens between the crosslinks and what is going to happen to them? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to measure two things. I'm going to measure the autocorrelation functions of the Rouse modes, the single chain Rouse modes for the strands, according to the constrained junction theories, that should just decay to zero. And I'm going to see how do these modes deform under strain. And qualitatively, it is pretty clear that if you have a tube like this, then it is sort of the long wavelength modes which are affected, and the short wavelength modes are not affected. Right? That's okay. So here comes the plot. So we have to go a bit carefully about it. So this gamma is my confinement parameter, which is just the result of measuring the autocorrelation function. So what you see here are results for the different Rouse modes. This is the first mode, second, third, whatever, and that's high modes. And you see they are confined, and the longer the wavelength is, the more strongly confined they are. On this axis, this is the excitation of the mode under strain, normalized to what you have in the phantom model. And then there are the predictions of these two theories, model A and model B. So I think I can make the point that model B does a pretty good job. So you really, if you talk about entanglements, you really have to model them by these more complicated deformation-dependent confining potentials.
So what are you varying? Are these different simulations? What do the different points correspond to?
That's a single simulation, if you like. It's a single system. And the data is taken under strain. I analyze the Rouse modes for the strands. And so I get, of course, modes with different mode number, sort of long wavelength fluctuations, short wavelength fluctuations. Now, this is the first mode. This is the second mode, the third mode, whatever. Now, this is the degree of confinement of the modes, just measured from the decay of the autocorrelation function. Yes, it's always the ensemble average over these modes in the system. And just say, and of course, the first mode is confined the strongest, and then it becomes weaker. And then I check, so that is a measurement which I do prior to stretching. So I analyze the fluctuations in the state of preparation. And then I strain the system, and I have to see, is the microscopic deformation the one I expect? So that's these two predictions here. And the other thing is I have to look at the stress. That's what I'm going to do on the next slide, but I might have a question.
What strain will this take?
50% elongation.
And what is the number of entanglements per chain? About two or three?
Yeah. Or even one. I mean, the strand length here was like 44. What we usually say entanglement length is 35. The strains are a little bit pre-stretched. So I wouldn't want to infer that number really from these simulations with this very particular connectivity. That's not the point of it. The point of it is that you can just, for a given topology, you can try out if this way of describing localization makes sense or not.
Is it Rouse modes of end-to-end distance? Junction to junction distance? Or
no. That's exactly what you have to take out. So if you have to say, I take out the end-to-end distance and I look at the deviation of monomers from the equilibrium position, which is sitting on the straight line between the ends. And that again looks like Rouse modes, but they are sine modes and not cosine modes. And then you get rid of all these nasties.
And it's widely projected on the tube, so it's in perpendicular direction.
I don't know what the tube is. So no. I do it in x and y.
In perpendicular direction to the distance between the
engine? No, it's in Cartesian coordinates.
In direction of the
principal direction,
yes.
Of deformation.
Yes, exactly. Which is the reason for my question the other day, that of course you would like to do something else, but that's not what I'm doing here. And for the purpose of the model I am investigating, what I'm doing is what I should do.
I'm confused in the sense that you were speaking about confinement of junction points and confinement of the chain.
Yeah.
So this plot is about confinement of junction points?
Of the chains.
Of the chains.
Yeah.
Average over the whole ensemble.
Average over the whole ensemble.
Mm-hmm. So model B then is, I guess neither model, but in particular, model B is not a complete theory because it doesn't predict the relationship between gamma and mode number. That's something you extract from the simulation.
That's what I extracted here because I didn't know what I showed you five plots before, that you can just go from real space where you wanted to start to mode space where I could understand things. So in principle, this is complete. There's only a single number, the strength of the springs, the tube diameter.
And the delta used one.
And the?
The delta parameter used was one for the full length.
The delta parameter.
Well,
No. No, that's, you mean this gamma thing, right?
Delta. There was delta. Some delta that was the strength of confinement.
That's the gamma, which is.
I'm sorry.
My stupidity. Okay. That's off. Okay. That's completely puzzling. So I always mean gamma here. I'm sorry. Didn't see. That was the one bit you didn't get, right?
Then what's gamma in the next?
That's the same thing. And this should also be a gamma. So I don't know why I mixed these up.
So the big bang is predicted.
Yes. Well, that when I originally did it, I didn't see that. Okay. Good. Now where are we?
Ralph, there's no special in the constrained mode. There's no special extra treatment of constraints of the junction points themselves, they're treated like any other monomer.
Yeah, that's my question.
Okay, so what I'm doing there, what I'm saying is when you write down the theory, the ideal thing is to use the true generalized Rouse modes, so to be eigenmodes of the Kirchhoff matrix. Now, that may be not so practical, but you can, so what I do in these cases is I say I use some approximation to the eigenmode spectrum, like in solid state physics, where I say, if I look at the crosslinks, I do something like the Einstein approximation, where I say, okay, they can fluctuate independently around their rest positions. And then I look at the strands between the crosslinks using these sine Rouse modes. And that way, I chop these two things apart. That's an approximation to the true eigenmode spectrum. And the advantage of doing it this way is that you get some ensemble averaging from your sample, right? So, okay. Now, come on. The other thing is stresses or shear moduli. So what you see here, I mean, like 8 years ago, we didn't have that much CPU time, so we only have 3 samples. So what I plot here is, if you like, the strand density, the inverse length of the strands against the shear modulus, and I've divided out what you expect from the phantom model. So that would be 1. Without entanglements, it's 1. Now, the upper limit from a classical theory is the junction-affine model, which is here. And from the strange prefactor, you see that's the problem of the pre-stretching, but I mean, you can still do the calculations. There's nothing weird about it. The black dots are what you measure by just looking at the mechanics of the whole thing. The red dots is the classical contribution to the strain, which cannot really explain it. And since we have seen before that the other sort of the chains between the strands crossings are confined as well, so if you take that into account, it looks a lot better. It's not perfect yet, but that is sort of the resolution to which I could, at the time, measure things. So this looks qualitatively wrong. Here there is some hope, but it might also be more complicated than all these theories about Gaussian chains we're talking about, right? Okay. Now, what I have to do is I somehow have to get away from these regular idealized systems for which I have a formally exact solution of the model. And don't forget the fine print. If I want to explain anything that goes on in more realistic systems, then I have to build in random connectivity or something like that. And now, since the whole solution is sort of always sums over the eigenmodes of the Kirchhoff matrix, and I don't know anything about the Kirchhoff matrix, that's a bit difficult. So we are back to step not one, but maybe two, and we have to worry about polydispersity, dangling ends, self-loops, and we say, this is the bit where we have some idea of how to do it. Now, fortunately, there is Sam Edwards, and 25 years ago, he looked at that problem and said, isn't that very similar to what we have already done here? Because what you can do is you can look at the statistics of long paths through a phantom network. You can imagine you did the cross-linking starting from very long chains, and then would look at these chains. And if we do that, can we not say, if we average over many of such paths, that since the position of the cross-links on these chains is random, that we can get away by describing sort of the ensemble averages of many such things by, again, a tube model where we say there is some kind of confinement of localization due to the fact that these chains are part of a solid, of a network, and but we make it homogeneous along the chain. So that's the Warner-Edwards model. The advantage is that now, sort of my intrinsic connectivity is the one of a linear chain. So in that case, I know the Rouse modes, and I can calculate observables because I know over which mode spectrum I have to integrate. And the people who actually did that first, this in the simple manner, Tom and Daniel Reed, because what Warner and Edwards did was one of these messy replica things, and Michael already said that we have to get away from that, and I think I wholeheartedly agree. Okay, so that is a model A tube, Warner Edwards, and so we have gotten rid of the connectivity. This bugger is still there, but maybe a natural thing to do is to say, well, we wanted to treat entanglements using a tube anyways, and now maybe we have two of them. So we have sort of the A tube for the connectivity, we have the B tube for the entanglements, and if you solve the sort of the B tube model, then you get what Hendrik and Straube did, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, Rubinstein, Panyakov, you recover these results from the formalism.
Well, can you comment on, I also thought that the thing that Daniel and I did was essentially just a sort of Rouse mode version of the model B gentleman that you have at the bottom there.
No, they had the different deformation dependence of the constraints. So you have the Rouse mode version of Warner and Edwards, and that is a perfectly reasonable thing for Warner and Edwards to do because they were worrying about phantom networks under strain. Now, these gentlemen were worrying about entanglements, and then they had good reasons, which I sort of confirmed by what I've just shown you, to make this deformation dependent, and then you get the model B tube. So what I'm saying now is...
We found the solution, we found the problem.
So what I'm saying now is that if we want to do this again, looking at a long path through a real network where we have both effects, and then we have these two types of confinement, then because under strain they behave qualitatively differently, then instead of sort of effectively lumping all the confinement into either this model, which is what you guys were doing, or this model, what Traube has been doing all the time, is maybe not the nicest thing to do. So what you should do instead is look maybe at a double tube model, where these two things are there, and the question is, can one solve it, and is it any good, right?
What can I think again? What are the two things I'm missing? The second one.
The second one. What I'm saying is we have two types of confinement.
Yep.
One is because the chain is part of a phantom network, and the other connectivity, and the other is due to the fact that there are entanglements.
But for phantom network, just the ends, nothing else is confining.
Yes. So I'm looking.
Where's the tube?
Yeah, Michael. I'm looking at a long path through this phantom network, where there are many crosslinks on this long path. That's the way I'm trying
to... You're not treating the sex strand between crosslinks.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. The strand between crosslinks, we know how to do it. That's what we have done before, and that's easy and straightforward for a regular network structure. But if you want to do it in a system with polydispersity, if you imagine doing the same kind of mode analysis that I showed you, this is pretty messy. So now I'm trying to sweep what I don't know and what I don't want to care about under the carpet, that is the irregularities and the connectivity, and I say Warner and Edwards 25 years ago have given us a recipe for that, if it's any good, it's something one has to see, but if I use that recipe and I also want to take into account entanglements, then I have these two things to worry about simultaneously, and that's what I'm doing.
So why is the first thing a tube rather than phantom network? How do you know which path to take?
Exactly.
Why is that tube?
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's put it this way. If I only have to worry about the entanglements, and I could do that for the regular structure, that means that I have to know the Kirchhoff matrix and the eigenmodes of the whole thing. So that keeps the whole exact connectivity. I don't know how to average over that. So what I do is I cheat for that part, and I look at linear chains, and I make them part of a network by using this Warner-Edwards formalism.
Let's say there is no entanglement.
Then I only need model A.
And why model A is different from a regular phantom network? That's the part
it shouldn't be. It is just a way of...
So why are there any tubes? Why
why isn't it just a phantom network of random? I mean, that's the part I'm trying to see.
Yeah.
No, I think what you're talking about.
Exactly. That is the idea of Warner and Edwards 25 years ago, to say, well, if you have a random connectivity, that's a difficult problem. Now, if you want to say something about, for example, neutron scattering from a phantom network under strain, then if you want to do this exactly, I don't think anybody has done that. It's a messy thing. So now you say, I represent my phantom network with this random connectivity by an ensemble of long paths through the network, which are effectively confined them, right? I mean, if they are part of a network, they cannot just go all over the place. And that's the trick.
The thing is, you don't have to use the word two. It would be sufficient to talk about quenched and annealed parts of the correlation functions for the room.
That is true. And I have to admit that all these things puzzled me for a long time, because I never understood why anybody did that or did something else. But what Warner Edwards really had in mind was this problem, a phantom network under strain. And you just use the word tube, because what you want to produce in the end is a sausage, and a tube is a reasonable way of doing it. So.
Actually, I think one other point that looks important is a successive model. Should I take a successive model B to be evidence to be evidence that the tube volume is constrained, is preserved?
If this is an entanglement thing, yes. Okay. If I want to model entanglements, I should do that.
Wait a second. If model B doesn't have preserved volume, tube volume.
It doesn't have conserved
tube volume, is not
sausage conserved volume. Well, if you take a volume and you do an affine deformation on the volume, and your original deformation is volume conserving, then your tube is volume conserving.
No, I'm sorry.
Well, are you talking about the tube, or are you talking about the sausage?
I'm talking about the mu squared as volume spanned by the chain, undeformed versus deformed.
I wholeheartedly agree, but then you talk about the sausage.
Ralph uses those terms very precisely, and we have to agree. At least while he's giving the talk, we understand what he means by tube and sausage. What Ralph means by tube are the positions of the effective confining points of the other ends of the localizing Gaussian springs. And what he means by sausage is the blown out constrained dynamics of the chain.
Okay, so what is the, how far away are the constraining points from the chain?
In the continuum limit, very far away, right? But
so there is no tube. It's much larger than your chain. So the whole volume is. So
it's out.
Okay, don't worry about it.
Defining the deforming world, so of course the deforming is possible.
Yeah. Okay. So.
We have to use them.
You cannot define a tube by looking at the points of attachment. I'm sorry, it doesn't form any connective object.
It's true.
Well, the tube is an imagination of our mind that we use to produce the sausage, which is something we can measure.
I'll say until 12 o'clock noon today, we have to use tubes for the extremely non-disconnected, highly topological mathematical object, which is this dispersed collection of points.
Okay, so first question, is this thing solvable? Answer, yes. It's just slightly more messy than what I told you before. The thing is still diagonal in these Rouse modes, so still I can do it by looking at modes individually, but now I have sort of two of these harmonic forces acting on the mode, pulling to different positions, and by A and B I denote sort of these qualitatively different contributions, because this one here is strain dependent. So again, I have to say, where am I going to put these anchoring points or whatever? Well, I have conditions again. I have the condition that if I switch off entanglements and go back to phantom, I should get the right structure averages. If I switch off crosslinks and still have the entangled melt, I should get the right thing. And if I both effect simultaneously, still I should get the same thing. That fixes my distributions for where these tubes are, and they are correlated, as they should be. Now, but still, the connectivity which I keep in the theory is just for a linear chain. I can calculate things. Now, is that any good? Now, the simplest way of finding that out, I think, well, not the simplest way, but the safest way, maybe, is to use simulations as before. And that is what we're working on now, and that is what Carsten Swanenborg is doing. So he's analyzing the data that Kurt and Gary have assembled over the time and are still assembling, so it's a pretty big chunk of data. Now, what I'm showing you now is really new, and so I haven't had time to check everything of it. Now, so conclusions are preliminary, except one, that's this here. If you want to get any reasonable results from such an analysis, these systems have to be pretty big, because otherwise all these sort of self-averaging things, which I hope to are realistic when I write down the theory, are just not true. So they have to be really huge. And that means like a quarter of a million monomers and then thousands of chains. Otherwise, this is just nonsense. Okay, so first question to ask, strain dependence of the sausage diameter, so the thing that we can see. The way we measure it is that we actually look at the motion of the crosslinks, and we just measure, under strain or not under strain, their mean square displacement, parallel and perpendicular to the elongation.
Why don't you trace all monomers?
Because I have a stupid model.
No,
it's true. Believe me, I come back to that. So I do it for the crosslinks and for a good reason. Now, if I do that, I get these red points. And to my great delight, when Carsten tried to fit the result of that theory to it, he got that black line here. And that doesn't look entirely unreasonable. So that made me very happy when I got that last week. Now, let's just review the alternatives. Model A says fluctuations are independent of strain, so that would be a straight line, which is not true. Model B says the tube deforms. That's okay, that's the funny thing. The tube deforms in a manner which is affine. Now, what comes out of these theories, if you do it for the sausage, is it's square root of affine. So I think, again, Straube was the first who had that. And Jesus, do you remember how he was trying to rub that in? And I was like, what is he talking about? But it's true. So, but that would be this thing here, sort of the best part here.
But that's what people call tube diameter.
Yes, I know. And I hate it because it just, I mean, these things have confused me for a long time, I must say. And I find it easier to say, let's call it the sausage. But okay, I'm not sure that he, well, I mean, a tube, I mean, just if I think about the word, that the tube is a potential, the confining thing. I mean, just I've always understood the word in this way, and I think it is the way it is used in the calculations. Now, what comes out is something you can see, and it's not the same thing. Yeah, anyway. That's fine. So now the other thing is we want to worry about actually the deformations of the chains. And so what do we know? We know if you just look at sort of the mean square, well, end-to-end or segment extension, as under strain, parallel and perpendicular to the elongation. If this thing is long enough, then this has to be affine. Just, I mean, this is a solid. If you do it locally, then the strain is not going to affect it because the fluctuations always win. Now I'm just going to do two stupid manipulations here. So if I take this, I subtract the phantom result, so I have something which comes from zero here. Then I'm just going to normalize it to the asymptotic result, and then I have a function, oops, come on, which goes from 0 to 1 and which measures the degree of affinity of the deformation. And, well, I can see it. The nice thing is that if you do that for model A or if you do it for model B, you get a universal curve because all the lambda dependence is taken out by this way of normalizing it. So you should be able to put data for arbitrary strains all together on one curve here. If you do it for model C, then it should be somewhere between these. That's at least what I thought.
Sorry, what's DT? Is that a sausage or a tube? No,
this is the sausage. Well, sort of, at some point I have to... Yeah, I know. Never that, because that's what everybody uses. And then if I'm going to plot the S... It is confusing me as well, I admit. Now, these are results for real networks. And normalized with the sausage diameter I just showed you. So you can say there's even a theory to predict why it does what it does. And so this is all results. Red is X, green is Y, so parallel, perpendicular, strains from point A to 2.5. And it's all falling onto this line. I find that kind of cute, actually.
Which line is that, sorry?
That's actually the Model A line. That bothers me a bit because I thought they should be between these. But that's one of the things I have to check.
The blue one is Model B line.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I don't understand that, actually. But okay, that's what it is. Now, why is this so interesting? Because, and that's for you, Tom, you can think about scattering, right? Now, scattering is just a particularly unfortunate way of plotting what I just showed you. because sort of this structure factor here, which is unreadable, of course, is just a double integral over e to the minus q squared times these the not normalized to the real distances in space. Now, that sort of, from the theory paper, is just comparing for the same degree of confinement what you would get from model A, B, or C. So C is sort of different mixtures of entanglement and crosslinks. And it's difficult to see anything, but what you should see is that you don't see much. Sort of the differences between these models for the scattering curves are pretty small. So if somebody comes about and writes a paper and says he has confirmed model B, for example, because something even more spectacular happened, then I would not agree. The other thing is there were these losanges, and at least from that theory, you don't get anything. I mean, it's just Gaussian, you get ellipsoids, right? And I didn't put the plot in, but they don't seem to be in the data either. But that is still scattered data. The other thing, you can try to calculate elastic properties. And you see, I mean, you can calculate things, and of course, now we have to sit down and try to see whether or not they're any good.
Well, do these theories have excluding volume or excluding
them? Yeah, no. There is something there. And that's one of the things.
That, the
well, that's a thing. Yeah, for a single chain scattering factor, I don't think you really need that. But I think you need it, but it's more subtle than.
If you have a single chain, that single chain on its own with the potentials you get would be hugely swollen. Why is it not swollen? It's swollen because of all the other chains around.
Yes, but that's why I treated Gaussian in the first place, right?
But when you strain things.
Anything
but the Gaussian result, the chain, is a result of cancellation of two large numbers, self excluding everyone else, and for itself, and compressive exclusion for all its neighbors. Once you muck up the thing by anything that happens, excluding
them. I perfectly agree. And then again, how do we learn? We learn by comparing sort of the true thing to the simple thing we can maybe understand. So this I can understand. I can get the data for the real thing, which has everything, and I can see, does it matter, does it not matter? I think that's the kind of information we can appreciate.
You're a wonderful student cracking out single-chain structure.
Of course he is, like mad. But maybe in 2 weeks. So I think this is, well, a pretty complete sort of implementation of that original idea of Edwards, taking into account that maybe you should treat confinement due to cross-linking and entanglement in different ways. And the nice thing is you can really test sort of really the heart of that theory in simulations. So, but the problem is it's not a real tube. And that was your question. Because what it does is it confines monomers at positions in space. There is no such thing as a longitudinal degree of freedom which would allow rotation. It's just not in that theory. Right? Again, comparison will show why or not this is important, and this strain function is something where I have some ideas why it should not be important, but Michael says he has solved the other thing, and we'll see if that compares to the data or not. Okay, so there are two more things which I wanted to do, but what's the time?
12, 15 minutes.
15 minutes?
We have 15 minutes before we normally finish.
Okay.
So we can, I guess, choose between discussing what you've already told us or hearing a bit more.
Let's hear about tubes versus
clips. Yeah. Okay. That's interesting.
But that is going to be. I just switched that off, right? Is that what we're doing? Okay. Okay, so this tubes versus siblings, that I will make very short. It is something that was prompted by a discussion we had the other day, and then you said, well, the real model, the good model, is the one which I have presented, plus not fixing sort of arbitrary links on these chains, but making them slip links. Well, now there's one way of testing that, and we have done that not to test it, but I mean, anyways, and that is swelling. So you take a network like the ones we have been talking about, and you swell it. Now, if what I told you so far is the essence of the truth, then since the confinement changes in a manner which is affine with the macroscopic probe, it actually means that it becomes less and less and less important if you swell the sample. In fact, there's nothing in these equations which would stop you from swelling such a network as far as the phantom network could swell, because these constraints just go away. Now, that is our finely deforming tube that would say that. Now, unfortunately, if you look at what happens if you do such a simulation, and that's, well, hardly visible, but anyways. So what I plot here is, this is sort of the inverse strand length to some power. This is the equilibrium degree of swelling. And that straight line is sort of Flory-Rayner theory. Now, Flory-Rayner theory doesn't have entanglement, so you would say if that was the whole truth, then the data should be more or less on that line. However, what they do, if the strands become longer and longer and longer, it saturates somewhere. And it's effectively, you can say, you do Flory-Rayner theory with the entanglement length as effective strand length. So it means it is more like slip links, right? Because slip links, they can't go away. Or at least it has some aspect of that in it. And sort of this finely deforming tube cannot be anything. And not be everything. So I think that's a point I should make. Now the other business is about, well, you asked that question, where does this thing actually come from? Do we understand anything of this? So I don't claim I do. Anyways, so worry about it a little bit. Topological models of rubber elasticity. So in a sense, if you take a more fundamental point of view, then what you should do when you do the statistical mechanics of these systems is you should specify this topological state, that is the entanglement for the whole network, which is the result of your preparation procedure. And then you can do something to the system, stretching, swelling, whatever. But whatever when you calculate expectation values, you have to do that with a restricted partition function, which only allows for those states which are compatible with the initial quench topology. Now, this is relatively simple if you just look at two rings, and then you can use topological invariance from what the mathematicians give us. And the simplest one is a Gaussian linking number, and you can get it by just sort of giving plus and minus signs to crossing points in two-dimensional projection, and that's something one can do. Now, well, I'm not going to show you how messy it looks if you try to do that analytically. Now, that's one thing. The second thing is you have to worry about, if you do such a theory, what is the probability of having such states? That's what the mathematicians don't really do. And the third thing is you have to say, well, what's going to happen under strain? Now, I think the essence of most topological theories of rubber elasticity is actually contained in a simple argument, which was given by Bologodsky in 74, where they said, well, this is going to be horribly complicated, but what we can do is something which is very similar to the trick one uses to introduce the linear entropic springs, which represent chains in a melt. So you say, well, I look at two rings, and I look at their centers of mass. And clearly, there are more conformations when these centers of mass are close together, if they are linked, than when they are far apart. So that means there is a higher entropy, and that means that there is sort of a free energy related to that distance, related to the distance-dependent linking probability. And you can construct again, entropic springs, which act between the centers of mass of the linked rings and might give you a contribution to stress. Now, it was actually Gressley and Pearson, who just took that idea and said, okay, now what we're going to do is we're just going to put that into the usual network theories we have under the simplifying assumption that the centers of masses of these meshes or rings we have in the system changes in a manner which is affine with the macroscopic strain. That's, of course, not correct, but it's not so bad, and it's not more cruel than all the other assumptions which go into that. So that is the picture you would get from that, and the result looks also very similar to what we know for the simple theories, because, again, it's a thing about entropic springs being stretched in a manner which is affine. So you get an entanglement contribution to the shear modulus, which is proportional to the density of linked meshes. And then if you say, well, if that is all, then my real shear modulus should be just the phantom modulus plus this thing. And there might be a little prefactor because, of course, we're doing things wrong. Now, I think this is still the only quantitative test of such an idea, even though it's not really new. Because what can you do in the simulation? Well, in the simulation, you just sit down, you have your system, you know where everybody is. You can calculate if or not meshes are linked. That was one of the reasons why we looked at these diamond networks in the first place, because that seemed like a simple thing to do. So you can just calculate the density of linked meshes, and then you can do such a plot here, which is sort of, these are the three different systems we had. So now we look at the difference between the measured shear modulus, the one we expect from the phantom model without constraints, and divide it by the measured density of linked meshes, and that looks pretty much like a constant.
Okay, rho n, your definition is the Gauss winding number?
It's the density of linked meshes. I have all mesh pairs in my system, and whether they are linked.
You have a one-bit measure of that.
Exactly.
What the winding number
exactly.
Is.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
But these
chains are fairly short. So I mean that sort of you would say even the prefactor is reasonable. If you do the calculation with the whole thing, you get 1.3. So okay, fine. Now. I'm not saying that this would explain it all, because there's a catch. And the catch is that if you just calculate how this density of entangled meshes depends on the length of the rings, I take again this Olympic gel, then what you see is, well, it's not independent of chain length. No, it decreases with 1 over square root of n. So you cannot get a tube model from that, or you cannot get a plateau modulus in the limit where the chains become infinitely long, because there is something missing in there, right? Now, one possibility are multi-loop interactions. Another possibility is that, and Tom pointed out, I was just distinguishing between entangled and not entangled. Maybe you should go and start analyzing these ugly things that the mathematicians tell us can exist. Unfortunately, we don't know with which probability.
You can look for them.
You can do that. Yes, yes, yes. And there are people doing that. Okay, maybe. I have another one for links. Okay, this was a knot table. Now, since Michael says I'm showing it the wrong thing, I'm setting it right, but now, for this one, can you tell me quickly if it's a knot or a link? I mean, probably not. So that's just a mess. So you don't want to do that. What you can do is you can look again at that simple theory, or at least at the simplest topological invariant, which is this Gaussian linking number. So there is, well, let's start with the formula. There is an integral formula for that, which looks like this. You don't see much if you look at it quickly. But it's not so difficult. So it's a double integral over the two contours of the two rings. And basically, this is a 1 over r squared. It's the distance between the segments on one and the other ring. And this here is related to the relative orientation of the segments. Now, for flexible chains, what you can say is that this up here is basically a random number. You don't really care about it. If that is basically a random number, you can try and estimate the result of the integral. And if you do it, you get something which is wrong, because you get that the mean square linking number should be of order 1, which it is not. Rather, what you have to do is you have to look at this thing again, and you have to say, well, this is only really interesting if the two bonds, the two segments, come close to each other. And if they come close to each other, like my arm here and the stick, then basically what you get is, so this orientation here is just 1, or this 2π normalization of the thing. So whenever the segments come close to each other, you get a contribution which is of order 1. So now, how often does that happen for two rings which have the same center of mass? It happens square root of n times.
And so, well, by close, the only possible definition of the word close is within a single bond, definitely.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's not a step like the diameter.
Sort of the...
If you go to the Stift simulation, does this agree with the effect of two diameter on a persistent?
This is far away from that. I cannot really...
The same sign of the effect, or opposite sign of the effect. If I make chain stiffer, this tube get narrow or wider?
It goes in the right direction. We'll see that in a minute. I haven't... Okay, we'll see how far we get. Now, so what we find then is we have square root of n contacts, which produce a contribution of order 1 to this integral here. And the sign of that is just going to be random. So we have a random walk over the square root of n contacts, and so it means that the mean square Gaussian linking number between two rings should be of order square root of n. If you do it for a ring with a straight line, it's just a log. And that's something that was known 20 years ago. I think De Clauseau, Iwata, Tanaka had sort of either theories, sophisticated one, or just pointed out that that should be so. So one thing you can do, for example, in a simulation is you can say, okay, let me just try that out. Let me just follow the contour of one ring and just add up these things. And so that's what you see here. The first example is just a helix winding around a straight line. Then sort of the contribution, so if you pick up links with a constant velocity, and then the green one is a ring winding around a line, and the red one is for a ring winding around a ring. So it's like a random process, and there are jumps of order 1 whenever this thing comes close to the other contour, and then it goes away again. Oops. So in fact, what you can do is you can even correlate these jumps, or the probability for the occurrence of such jumps, with the probability of having sort of regionally dense systems, because I'm just doing that for random walks. And you can count the probability of having close encounters and the probability of having these jumps, and that seems to make sense that it is really the same thing. So the picture that emerges from this is that since we were still looking at two rings, we now have a situation where they come close to each other at the square root of n points. And for the Gauss linking number, what you would do is you would just add up all these plus or minus 1 signs. And sometimes you would find that these two rings are not really entangled, because they are sort of entangled in this way here and this way there, and then but you could just rearrange them and take them apart. But in a dense melt, that is not really the issue, because it means if you would do that, it means that you assume that you could really do this unwinding, or this large scale rearrangement, which you cannot because there are all the other chains. So what it means is that these local knots should be conserved locally. Iwata and Edwards, 1988 or 89. It's just you can do that. You can assume that. Now what you end up with is you end up with a density of local knots in your system, which depends on parameters like stiffness and volume fraction. And then you can say, well, now we want to relate that to the tube model. Well, the first thing is good, because if we have square root of n local knots between two rings, which share the same volume, but we have square root of n of these rings in the volume of a given chain, then we end up with order n local knots or constraints. So this gives you the correct scaling for the tube model. So the question is now, what do we get for the tube diameter? And then it gets a little bit messy. That's a bit surprising, because you could, by just saying, now we have these local knots here in space, what do we get from it? You can construct three different length scales. One is to say, well, it has to be something like the diameter of the knot, and that's where packing comes in, which was not contained in any of these arguments. But you could say, okay, you need a certain number of monomers to wind around it. So, I mean, that has some size. The other candidate is to say, well, that's just the spatial distance between the local knots. And the third is to say, well, that's the distance in space between local knots on the same chain. If you say, I'm staying on one chain, there's one knot here, one knot there, and that's the distance between entanglements. Well, unfortunately, these guys scale differently with things like stiffness and volume fraction. And you actually get most of the models, except the packing model, which seems the one that works best for the experiment. But the other ones you can get by saying it's either this or this. So that I find quite amusing, but I cannot really say that this is a derivation of the tube.
Well, can you tell us how each of these correspond to different, to the packing, which of these correspond to the packing length and which of them correspond
okay.
to different?
The packing length, the packing lengths I couldn't get out. And sort of the other two, it's either you say you count binary contacts or you say you count, oh, what's the other one? I forgot. It's just then you get, I don't remember which. That's one of the things that I'm sitting on my desk for 2 years now, and I have to write it up. Excuse me?
The simulation says which one is right.
I cannot tell you what the simulation says because I haven't tried it out. I mean, these were simulations for random walk rings, the data I showed you before. Oh, this is speculating about how one should go about going to the melt. So what one has to do, actually, and that's what we started doing, if one wants to go to the melt, is one has to look, and that's the last slide, somehow at multi-chain entanglements. And so by talking here, that's what you want?
No, I just want to ask a question when you stop for a breath.
Okay, I won't for a second. So if I want to look at multi-ring entanglements, what one can do is go back to this primitive path idea and just implement that on a computer for systems which were prepared with the right packing. So just sort of stretching these chains, you keep the endpoint, you stretch the chains, and then what you see is for a given chain, you really get kinks here in this conformation of the random path, the primitive path. And I think one should count these guys. And that is the way to go to the tube model. And the question is, can one relate that to the other arguments about topology? That would maybe close it up, but that's...
Is that unique?
I cannot claim that.
I mean, the wheeling in process.
Yeah.
Does it generate a unique picture there, or
it's a steepest descent thing. So in that sense,
it's not,
it is.
It's not unique, but it gives the same number of kinks.
Yeah.
It's not proper. The actual distance between them depends on which one is starting.
Okay, so if you do, what you should do is you should do it simultaneously for all of them.
With something which has the same tension in all chains.
No, because if the chain is not entangled, it reduces to a point. A ring can reduce to a point and a straight sort of this here like a straight line. You see these guys here. And that, if I may, that last sentence is what I would like to give you guys as a starting point for a slip link simulation, because then we have mapped the full system onto the slip link system, and we just see where it, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, Scott.
I'm confused about many things, but perhaps the most recent one is whether there's an unambiguous definition of what you mean by a local knot, and how you would know one if you saw one, since the definition was topological, but local in the end just run off, and I can't tell if it's knotted or not.
That is true, and what I would answer to this is, I would show you this plot again. And then if you look at this plot, which is measuring the Gauss linking number is the sum over all these contributions from the segments, and now I just add it up, and so it's the integral up to a certain point along the chain. And then this thing, if you look at it with loving eyes, seems to have jumps which are really sort of order 1 or 1/2 is good enough for me, actually. And that's when this thing comes close. But I would perfectly agree. I mean, that's making this rigorous. If you want to make this rigorous, you can only do it for closed lines. Now I'm saying, well, maybe I can get a reasonable result by looking at parts of the system. And
to get an example of something that's ambiguous, like around 8,000, it changes by about 1 over a somewhat longer distance. If two chains didn't come right next to each other.
Yeah.
Like
so that's a chain with a line. So if it's two chains, then they have these really big jumps here.
So this is for two chains. What happens if the chain comes back to itself and not counted?
Exactly, because this is this is the Gauss linking number which forgets about these things. So in a sense, you would like to include them. Question, are they important? Now you would say you have in a dense melt of order n contacts with other chains and of order square root of n contacts with yourself. So you may get away by neglecting it, and that's why maybe the Gauss linking number is a reasonable thing.
Anyway, the definition or an offer definition was the integral, the Gauss linking number integral, but over a finite stretch of chain with a finite other stretch of the chain.
Okay. Yeah, that's the Edwards and the Water thing. So I didn't think they didn't do the scaling bit so much. I mean, but that's the essence of what they proposed. And okay, just one more sentence. I think this picture of the local nodes, I find it reasonable. And to me, this leads directly to slip lengths. I mean, that is something that, okay, Michael.
In a melt, you have order n contacts with the cell, if you consider local contacts, which is, so if you account for a chain going out, moving out, all the distance, and then coming back, there's a finite probability of doing it, and it scales linearly with molecular weight. So you have order n self nodes, or the chains itself. So I don't think you can easily dismiss by a simple scale.
The order n?
Well, if I consider a given strand of a me or something, there's a probability of a third or a fifth or some number of it contacting with itself or not with itself. It's a finite number, and then you can just construct the whole chain out of many of those sections, each of them independent, presumably. So just local contact scale. It's a global one that scale, square root of n, but local one scale is n. And since you're talking about local nodes here, I wouldn't quite take your
function. Okay, we'll have to try it out. But sort of, I would then go to the multi chain picture, which.
Larger than
independent of n.
But I think what you need is, from these topological things, they tell you why maybe the sort of, you would say you have order of n contacts with other monomers, but sort of 10 per monomer, so huge, and the tube requires also order of n constraints, but many, many less, like 1 per ne. And these topological arguments maybe tell you a little bit why the prefactor is so small, because you have to wind around, often when you do it and you wind back, then it doesn't count, things like this. It's okay.
Well, just going back, I was going to ask you about constraint mode analysis, about another sum you might do with the stress, which isn't quite as sophisticated, perhaps as relating with shear modulus to the invariance. But the constraint mode analysis that you made, given that the fluctuations are all Gaussian, you can ascribe an entropy loss per confinement of any independent Gaussian mode. Can you do a check on the shear modulus which you measure directly with a sum over all the Gaussian modes and then measure confinement to check that the bank,
I think this is actually the essence of this result which I showed you, where I showed that you could relate the difference between the phantom model prediction for the shear modulus to the true shear modulus to the density of entanglements. On the other hand, I could also account for that difference by doing this constraint analysis.
Well, as Greg was asking, was simply have you or could you practically calculate the shear modulus in two ways? One, by just measuring, integrating by time over the course.
Yeah.
or secondly, just by summing, by looking at the constraint of all the nodes that you
yeah.
have in your data, calculating delta n's.
I think that's what I've done and showed you,
done.
Right? Because I measured the thing, the real one.
Yes.
I analyzed the fluctuations and the confinement of the modes in the initial state, and I could sort of more or less predict the reaction to strain in terms of the shear modulus.
Okay.
And I analyzed the topology of the thing, and I could also get a reasonable estimate of the shear modulus. So these things seem to be consistent with each other, but I cannot really show you a theory which quantitatively starts from a topological analysis and gets the two parameters, which would be nice.